We like our movies with sound on them and have preferred them that way for the better part of a century, but some movies from the silent film era are so visually riveting, tell their stories so well that they are still held in esteem. That's the case with the 1925 Soviet film Battleship Potemkin, which tells the story of uprising against the Tsarist regime of Russia in 1905. The film is the centerpiece of the final concert of the season for the Brit Festival Orchestra on Sunday evening in Jacksonville. The film will play while the orchestra will play a recently arranged score for it. Nathan Farrington is one of the bass players in the Brit Festival Orchestra and one of the co-arrangers for the project, and he's in the studio with me. Nathan, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the film is nearly 100 years old, but regarded still as a masterpiece. What are some of the things that make Battleship Potemkin still so riveting?
Battleship Potemkin is an example of, it is the advent of many of the things that we take for granted in modern filmmaking that we see in every single movie and TV show that we watch these days. This genius director who came out of the Soviet Revolution, he was literally in the Red Army, and loved art and film and thought that film was the future and thought that film had a unique power to manipulate people's emotions. He came up with the concept of montage. Sergei Eisenstein, he literally thought up montage. And montage is something that is involved in every single show we watch, every movie we see. And all it is taking images that you wouldn't normally see next to each other in life and smushing them together. And each of the images ends up informing the other. So when you see Rocky running and then Rocky banging against the meat, and then ascending the steps, you get this sense of triumph that wouldn't necessarily, you know, you wouldn't feel that as you watch Rocky in the meatpacking house in 30 degrees. But you're welled up and drawn in with the emotion that's taking place as a result of this thing. And Eisenstein had all of these theories. He wrote about it and talked about it and developed it and was doing this in 1925. And you watch it today and it looks like a modern movie. It looks like something that would be coming out of Hollywood right now.
The camera work is incredible. I mean, I was just appreciating it yesterday, looking at that. Some of the, you can find the entire film on YouTube with either Russian subtitles or you might prefer English, but visually the images are just that good. I mean, it's surprising for its time.
He was so the 1925 James Cameron. I mean, mm-hmm. he's using lenses that they developed. He's bringing in extra people that, you know, no one had ever thought of using the number of extras and the number of people involved in these shots. And he's putting the cameras up on pedestals and looking over people's shoulders. And none of this had been done before. Before that, silent movies were essentially a picture of a stage. It was similar to an experience that you would get at a live theater event.
So we've established the visuals then, and there have been several scores to accompany the film, but obviously none on the original film since there was no sound. Did you study those earlier scores, or were you happier not knowing what was on there?
We started from scratch, but what's interesting is that Eisenstein, part of his weird avant-garde revolutionary, you know, notion of the role that this art should play in people's lives was that he hoped that it would be rescored over time.
So I noticed that. He thought every 20 years there should be a new score.
Can you imagine? These days, these scores are absolutely integral and are something that we use to identify music. Think of the Star Wars, you know, think of Star Wars without the Star Wars theme or the Harry Potter movies without their score. And they're linked at the hip forever. It's part of the art. But Eisenstein believed that he could rejuvenate these images if they were being reset using sometimes modern music. Our idea was to take the powerful voice of the classics and to use the music that we love in the orchestra that we've spent our lives getting to know and to take those special moments that are powerful in our minds and link them up to the movie in the way that a modern movie score that was written specifically for a scene would do. And so we went about weaving these special moments together and creating this thing that uses the genius of the classics and the weight of the classics to pair and add to the genius of what Eisenstein did. And it's a pretty neat experience.
So this is a project that Teddy Abrams, the conductor and music director at the Brit Festival Orchestra, brought with him from the Louisville Orchestra. So tell us about the genesis of it there.
I used to send Teddy little tiny videos. Teddy's a school buddy from our days at the Curtis Institute of Music. And I used to send Teddy little videos of things that I would take, 10-second clips that I would then go score using music that I knew or songs that I thought fit it well. And I would send them to him over a couple years. And he came to me and asked if I wanted to do it on a bit of a larger scale. So we started with the notion of laying a few pieces over Potemkin and seeing how it would affect the movie. And what we ended up with was using 22 pieces on this thing that range from solo organ music, the big toccata and fugue from you know, the organ thing that everybody knows from Bach's music, up through some quartet pieces where you're hearing just a couple of string players playing Schubert's quartet music, Death and the Maiden, and a Janacek quartet. And then we go through some of the earlier symphonies like Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony and Stravinsky's, you know, moving into the 20th century, we get into Stravinsky's Firebird and into Tchaikovsky and through Mahler. And I'm not listing them chronologically. I'm sort of listing them as the size of the orchestra increases, as the size of the voice of what we're bringing increases. And it follows along as the movie gets more intense and as the stakes and what's going on with the sailors becomes more important. We tried to build the orchestra's voice as the movie built, and it ended up being this thing that showcases the orchestra uniquely in a live-to-picture film. We've had problems in the music world where modern films are being shown a lot in the concert halls. But what's happening, they'd hoped that getting an audience into the concert hall would mean that the audience would then follow and come listen to the orchestra itself some other night. But they're finding that people come to see Harry Potter for Harry Potter. And then they go home. But this is to feature the orchestra. You're coming to hear the group live and experience its power as you watch this cool piece of 100-year-old Soviet propaganda.
Nathan Farrington, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, bass player of the Brit Festival Orchestra and arranger of a new score for Battleship Potemkin, arranged from 22 pieces of fairly well-known bits of classical music. Questions, comments from you, welcome on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, 22 pieces you ended up with. I'm going to take a wild guess. There might have been 66 you considered at least.
Oh, we just started laying it. It was an interesting process. We just sort of started laying pieces whose energy we felt matched the scenes we were watching. We'd lay them on top and watch them for a while and see how long they worked, or if they worked, or maybe we slow them down a little bit, you know, and then you're jumping to something else. But it's interesting because we took into account the keys that each was in and the time that each was in and meaning the tempo, and tried to really weave it together to where it's a seamless thing. Each piece sort of grows out of the other piece, and we unwound it and made sure transitions were orchestrated. It's really been an interesting labor of sort of manipulation of these pieces that everyone should recognize.
Let's give credit to Sebastian Chang for his part of the project too. How did you guys divide up the work?
Sebastian is a brilliant young composer. He's a good friend of Teddy's from school as well, but he's been commissioned by places like the Detroit Symphony and is an amazing artistic voice himself. And is a master manipulator of the software necessary to take care of a project like this. So you're dealing with, I was counting the other day, you're dealing with 42 orchestral parts that are each 2,000 measures long. So you have 80,000 measures of dots and dashes to help communicate what we're trying to do with the orchestra. And Sebastian was in charge of assembling the grand vision, and he did just a marvelous job.
I can imagine you had to tweak tempos a bit. That's an easy thing to do. But now how about, did you change any keys? Did you do any transposition?
We would take sometimes, what we would look for were opportunities to come up with a transition where we could unwind the end of the excerpt that we wanted from one piece and sort of begin the excerpt to another. I mean, I guess in some sense it's like the mashups that people were seeing on Glee,
okay.
You know, but you know, sort of more complicated in the surgery that was necessary to make them all work out.
I hope this is the first show that's discussed Glee and Battleship Potemkin yeah. in the same
Eisenstein
conversation.
Would be so proud.
He would. So what happens when you have to cover 6 minutes of film, but you've got a 7-minute piece, or vice versa?
We looked for pieces in. What we looked for was the energy inside the music. And so you get some things where we're weaving in and out of Stravinsky and Debussy. We've got some Firebird that represents sort of the tumultuous waves that are taking place. And then we have this horrible officer on board the ship who's whipping people. And we had this motif that we took from the Debussy that represents the officer. And we would weave it in with the Stravinsky because we found that the keys all matched up and that it worked out. So we're talking about sometimes dipping into these pieces for just a few seconds before we go back to another thing. And I think you just have to be honest with yourself and maybe even excited a little bit that these are not the incarnations of these pieces that you're used to hearing, but the energy that they bring, and in fact, the moments that you get to experience inside these pieces, you don't have to sit around Mahler 1 to enjoy the huge climax of the last movement for an hour and a half. We get right to the point. We trim the fat from a lot of these things, and it should really be a terribly accessible experience for an audience. If you're intimidated by classical music, this is the concert to come see, because we're moving you through 300 years of music, and we are giving you the greatest hits, and hopefully there will be something inside there for you to latch on to.
And the film itself is an hour 15, something
exactly.
Like that?
Mm-hmm. In and out, hour and 15 mm-hmm. minutes is sort of the perfect length for sitting down. You know, the project appears esoteric on its surface, but Teddy is the master of communicating with an audience and working to make people aware of how we all fell in love with this. That orchestra is full of 30-year-olds who have dedicated their lives to this art form that takes some effort. It's not easy to just drop in and listen to this music sometimes. But the truth is that if you're open to relaxing into the energy that these pieces provide, the experience can be so powerful. And Teddy has really worked to use the visuals of this incredible movie and the moments from these powerful pieces to invite people in onto the hill on Sunday night and hopefully have a great experience.
Nathan Farrington, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, bass player at the Brit Festival Orchestra. We're talking about the Sunday night performance, which is the final one of the Brit Festival Orchestra season. It's the Battleship Potemkin, the film from 1925 by Sergei Eisenstein, with the orchestra playing the score for it, as arranged by Nathan Farrington from 22 pieces of classical music over the years. When it was first rehearsed, was there a lot of stopping, a lot of crossing out measures of music to stay in time?
I mean, this sort of just the librarians were hustling pencils behind both ears and making the thing work. I mean, you're sort of dealing with a Frankenstein monster when you put something like this on. And getting the nuts and bolts, the plumbing of the piece worked out is a major feat. And it's very interesting because I think this must be something that composers have lived with forever. I mean, the notion of translating these ideas into something that's written down and something that's on paper is quite a process, and it's an ongoing process. We've done revisions for this performance, which is the second performance of the piece, and I think we've done something like 3,000 edits to the parts that were played in Louisville and come up with, you know, something that's hopefully cleaner and can be put on a little bit more quickly. But this is, I think, the evolution of a show. I mean, this is what it takes.
It must be really satisfying to have it work, though, to go, oh, yeah, that's as good as we thought it was going to be.
It's pretty wonderful to enjoy the live music aspect of this experience, to see the 100 people on stage pulling and adding their energy and their life's work to the film, to the pictures that are taking place up on the screen, which have sort of been left behind for us for 100 years to interpret and to reimagine, and so you get this collective weight that is happening as a result. It is very satisfying.
When you think about it, I mean, you're adding so much here because there is no dialogue. I mean, yes, there are subtitles. People are, you know, shouting things to each other, and they're ending up on the screen for a few seconds for the audience to read. But by and large, this is you're making the sound of the movie. That's a weight.
When I came out of school, I moved to Los Angeles to play with the LA Philharmonic for a few years and had no idea what Los Angeles was about. Had a little sister who was out there acting, and I've become totally obsessed with the movie music world that is out there. And I think that Hollywood is just waking up right now to the notion of lending these time-tested pieces. These pieces have been through the filter of hundreds of years of scrutiny, and they are still being listened to for a reason. And oftentimes the genius decisions that those composers made to end up with the product that they ended up with are so similar to what you're seeing Eisenstein do. You write and you get into trouble, and then these brilliant men have a sixth sense about how to get out of trouble, and watching them do so can be the most satisfying part of the experience. But they are you know, when you combine those brilliant decisions that the composers made with the brilliant visual decisions that Eisenstein was making, I think there's potential for something really special. And I think Hollywood is starting to adopt it. You see it in like the King's Speech when they're using Beethoven 7 mm-hmm. for that incredible speech that he's making towards the end of the movie. And, you know, the use of classical music in big moments in Hollywood films is on the rise. And I think it's part of the future for sure.
That was particularly satisfying. My sister played Beethoven 7th in junior high school. I knew it well, and it was like, oh, yeah, finally somebody is making good use of this.
Marvelous. Marvelous.
So when you're playing in an orchestra along with a movie, can you even sneak a glance at the screen, or is this something
it's
just
tricky business, isn't it? Yes, we played a lot in the LA Philharmonic where we would go rehearse at the Bowl, and for the rehearsals, they would point some monitors inward so we could watch. But man, when it came time to play the show, they didn't care a bit if we got to enjoy the if we got to enjoy the picture. It's all business at that point.
Do you feel like the sailors down below?
Yeah, it's exactly right. There may be a revolution someday. Teddy has to watch out.
So I have to ask about the Odessa step sequence, which is one of the most famous in movie history, and what music you applied there.
I used Holst's Mars. It's interesting because the Odessa step sequence is one of the uses of montage. It's great. If you want to illustrate to people what montage is, the Odessa step sequence is fantastic because there's different types of montage. There's the type where he's cutting between camera shots at exactly the same rate. He gets into a rhythm. It's called metric montage. So you can literally count along with how many frames there are until the next cut. And you don't know this as you're watching movies, but it's happening everywhere. Go watch the montage from Rocky, and it's happening to the beat of that rock song. And the two things together are heavy. They're marvelous. So he's really manipulating his audience and to the fullest extent. And the Odessa step sequence is powerful as a result of these sort of subliminal messages he's sending.
So classic cinema, Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin from 1925 meets classic music from the last 300 years, 22 pieces plugged in by Nathan Farrington with help from Sebastian Chang into the orchestra at the Brit Festival. That'll be on Sunday night at 8 o'clock, isn't it?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Nathan.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you for having us, and we hope to see you all on the Hill.
Okay, that'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about rest in hour number 2 coming up.